from 89.3 KPCC. This is Take Two. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino and Ferry Martinez. Happy almost New Year to all of you. Coming up later in today's show, our cheat sheet for attending tomorrow's Rose Parade. We'll speak with our unofficial in-house parade expert, KPCC's Sharon McNary. Plus, there's a whole lot of new laws kicking in tomorrow that you might want to know about. They could affect you and your lifestyle. We'll walk you through some of them. But first, it is the last day of 2018, marking the end to the first year of the Trump tax plan. It's also the 10th day of the partial shutdown of the federal government. So what does this all mean for you and your money? Ava Rosen is a tax advisor, also known as the Tax Mama. Ava, welcome back to Take Two.
Well, thank you so much, Megan.
Thanks for joining us. Today is the last day of the year. If you want to make certain financial moves, looking ahead to 2019, looking back at your tax year of 2018, is there any one thing that all taxpayers need to be thinking of right now or doing before the day is done?
As you're aware, the government has shut down. People who are about to get levied or have their wages garnished, those are still going to happen because the computers are running. So this is a word of warning. If you haven't been responding to IRS notices, empty out your bank account now or pay those taxes, because otherwise there won't be any way to stop the levies and garnishments.
Now, let's start with some advice for homeowners. Is there still a tax advantage to paying January's mortgage in advance?
Oh, yeah, it's perfect. Because today's the last day of the year, so you've accrued the entire month of interest. So if you pay the January mortgage payment today, you get the full deduction this year. Those people who are like on the verge of being able to itemize or not, if you take all the deductions as much as possible this year, then skip them next year, push the December payment into January, then you'll be able to itemize again next year. Same thing with property taxes. Pay them early.
All right. Can you clarify the deal with itemizing deductions? There was a lot of talk last year about, you know, a lot of people switching from itemizing deductions. Who can itemize, who can't?
If you're single, you have a standard deduction of $12,000. So for a lot of people, unless they have an expensive mortgage, they're not going to be able to itemize at all. And if you're married filing jointly, it's $24,000. So most homes in California don't have mortgages that high with the current interest rates. And that's the biggest part of itemizing. The other problem that we have is the 12-point-something million people who have been using employee business expenses for forever no longer can use them. And some of these people, like union workers who pay very high dues, people in the entertainment industry, they're not going to be able to deduct anywhere between $10,000 and $50,000 worth of their out-of-pocket expenses, because there is no more deduction for employee business expenses.
All right. Another issue that has caused a lot of confusion with this new tax plan is charitable contributions, something we talk a lot about here at KPCC lately. What do people need to know about donating to charities? Is there anything people should be doing today to maximize the value of their giving?
Make the donations. If you're not able to itemize, gift the money to somebody you know who is able to itemize, and let them make the donation today, and they'll get the credit for it and the tax break for it, and they can do it in your name so, you know, that you look like you're still making donations and you're honorable.
All right. Also, a lot of confusion about how to calculate withholding from paychecks. So how can people figure out exactly how much should be withheld so they aren't, you know, left paying too much or too little at the end of the year?
Actually do a projection using tax software to see where you're going to be, how much your total liability is going to be for the year. And if you're doing it now and you fill out the W-4 for next year, what you can do is put zero as far as the exemptions that you're going to take. And then on the next line, you put in the amount you want withheld from each paycheck. So if you're going to get paid every week, you divide the amount you owe by 52. If you're getting paid once a month, divide it by 12, and then you'll get exactly the amount withheld that you need. If you don't have enough withheld, You may face penalties. Owing a couple of $100 doesn't sound like much, perhaps, but to some people, that might mean they can't make their rent payment at that time.
All right. Now, I understand today is an important day for those who are age 70 and a half or older. What do they need to do?
If they haven't made their required minimum distribution from their IRA account or their retirement account, they have to get that done by today, or they're facing 50% penalties. However, if they don't really need that income, they can have the money transferred directly to a charity and have that count as their required minimum distribution. They can transfer up to $100,000 to a charity. They won't pay tax on that. It will count as their required minimum distribution. And since they don't need the deduction anyway, they won't get the charitable contribution deduction.
Now, if you're someone who is lucky enough to have an investment portfolio, should you do there today?
Okay, well, if you know that you're going to have capital gains this year, you've had some losers in the past week or so, sell them to offset the gains. But you can sell your stock and get capital gains and maybe pay 0% if you're in the 10 to 12% bracket.
All right. Ava Rosenberg is a tax advisor, also known as the Tax Mama. She's been talking to us about financial moves to make today before the new year begins. Ava, thanks a lot.
Thanks, and have a less taxing 2019.
Hundreds of new laws will take effect in California tomorrow, and throughout the show, we'll remind you about a few of them that could have a direct effect on your world. Here's a big one, just in case you plan to celebrate the new year with a nice brunch out. If you like to have a straw with your drink, you'll have to ask for one. Full-service restaurants will no longer be offering them automatically. Also, if you have kids with you and they would like soda or juice with their meal, you'll have to ask for that too. The default drink on most kids' menus starting tomorrow will be milk or water instead of sugary beverages. You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino in for A. Martinez. As we reflect on the last year, it's clear that California has become home of the legal resistance to President Donald Trump and his policies. Since the president took office in January 2017, the state has filed 45 lawsuits against his administration on everything from the environment to health care to the most contentious topic of all, immigration. The California Report's Lily Jamali has the story.
Shortly after President Trump's 2016 victory, in a speech before a room full of climate change scientists, California Governor Jerry Brown left little doubt that the law would be the linchpin of his strategy to resist.
And in California, we got plenty of lawyers. So we got the scientists, we got the lawyers, and we're ready to fight. We're ready to defend.
Attorney General Javier Becerra took office just days after President Trump's inauguration, following his appointment by Governor Brown. Becerra is the man in charge of carrying out the legal attack on Trump's policies. Dan Levine is West Coast legal correspondent at Reuters News.
It's important to think about the Attorney General and AG Becerra as an instrument of the legal resistance, as opposed to the beginning and end of it. It's in all of the elected officials' interests in California to bring these types of challenges because it's going to be popular with a lot of voters.
Brown selected Becerra, a longtime congressman from Southern California, to fill the attorney general role after Kamala Harris left the post following her election to the U.S. Senate.
And the AG was up for re-election in 2018, and so one of the things that Governor Brown really wanted to do was appoint someone who could win and win handily. And so that was one of the attractions of Javier Becerra, who was the first Latino to ever be state AG.
Becerra has been litigious, to say the least, despite a soft-spoken demeanor. I spoke with him in October as the most recent migrant caravan was making its way through Mexico to the U.S. border. President Trump had just announced he'd be sending in troops.
My sense is that these migrants that are traveling by caravan are not looking for violence. And so I fear that this administration is sending the wrong signals to people about how it approaches not just these migrants, but the law.
Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, says Becerra has a lot of help, resources that few attorneys general have.
We have the people, we have the political will, and we have an attorney general's office that reflects the size of California, much bigger than other states who simply don't have as many people or don't have as much money for these suits.
Becerra's years in Congress came in handy as he staffed up with a big budget that Brown procured for the AG's office. Once again, Reuters' Dan Levine.
Becerra brought in very experienced, longtime Hill staffers who were very, very well-versed in immigration policy and could craft strategic litigation to combat different moves that President Trump was making.
Few areas have drawn as much outrage against Trump's policies than immigration. Becerra's office has filed about 10 lawsuits on that one topic, addressing everything from the separation of migrant parents from their children to the construction of the border wall. Becerra actually lost the battle on that one. A little over a year ago, the president said he would end DACA, the Obama-era policy that allows so-called dreamers, those who came to the U.S. illegally as minors, to live and work here for now. Becerra responded by suing the Department of Homeland Security. But he hasn't been alone. Three states have joined him in his suit. And in fact, another key player here in the state, the University of California, beat him to it. The university's president, Janet Napolitano, was the person who issued the memo creating DACA in 2012 when she was President Obama's Homeland Security Secretary.
I guess you could say that I take it a bit personally when the next administration just eliminated the program with seemingly nary a thought to the hardships they were causing.
Earlier this year, a federal judge temporarily halted the rollback of DACA, requiring the government to keep it in place despite Trump's wishes. Lee Gallant, a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union, says judges have wielded a key tool to stop not just DACA, but other policies, including one that commanded the world's attention.
They have issued what we call injunctions, stopping a policy or practice. Those injunctions have made clear that the government can no longer separate little children from their parents and must reunite those families.
In a legal tit-for-tat, the Trump administration took the rare step of trying to bypass the appeals court to get the DACA case heard by the Supreme Court, which still hasn't decided if it will hear the case. Regardless of what happens in Washington in 2019, California will likely remain central to the legal resistance against the Trump administration, so much so that Attorney General Becerra has even opened an office in Washington.
That's the California Report's Lily Jamali. Starting tomorrow, there will be a lot more laws on the books in California. Throughout the show, we're reminding you about a few of them, including some that will likely put the state further at odds with the Trump administration, like more gun regulations. Going forward, no one under the age of 21 can purchase a rifle or shotgun in California. 18 used to be the minimum age. Also, a lifetime gun ban will be in effect for anyone convicted of a serious domestic assault. Pasadena is getting ready for its big event of the new year, the annual Tournament of Roses Parade. It's now in its 130th year. More than 70 million people worldwide are expected to tune into it on television. But hey, the parade is right here, so why not see it in person? It's the quintessential SoCal thing to do. Last week, I spoke with Sharon McNary, KPCC's infrastructure reporter and unofficial Rose Parade correspondent. She shared some of her hot parade viewing tips gleaned from many, many years of attendance.
I don't think I've ever missed it. I make a point nearly every New Year's Day depending on the severity of my hangover, to run out of my house right at 8 in the morning to see the military B-1 jet fly over. Ooh. And then I go back in the house and watch the parade on TV and eat party leftovers and drink coffee. But if I'm feeling really chipper early in the morning, then I go watch it in person. I've viewed it from just about every perspective possible, from the super seats at the start to the very end of it as those last marchers are just straggling in.
Yeah. So say I want to get a view that's made for TV. What can I do to get in that section of the spectators?
For that section, you got to buy tickets in advance, about $90 a seat, if they're still available online, to sit at a TV corner. It's the beginning of the parade where Orange Grove makes it tighter than 90-degree turn onto Colorado Boulevard. And it can be challenging for marching bands and big floats to like make that tight turn. These are the top-end seats in the tall bleachers on Orange Grove. They've historically been the only place to see the made-for-TV song and dance numbers that lead the TV broadcast.
Ah.
Then you turn the TV corner onto Colorado. You have people in these tall bleachers on one side, and then the float building crew from two Cal Poly campuses in Pomona and San Luis Obispo on the other side in front of the Norton Simon Museum. And most of the grandstand spectators get there on charter buses. They're fed box breakfasts and coffee. And so after that, you get to the bulk of the 5.5-mile parade route along Colorado Boulevard, and farther down the street, the bleachers cost about $60 to $75 a seat.
All right, but there are people that can see it for free, right?
Oh, absolutely. Most people don't sit in the bleachers. They're standing 5 to 10 people deep behind the people who slept on the sidewalk and put their own chairs and sleeping bags on the street.
And I understand there are even ways to experience the parade for those who might have a visual impairment. How does that work?
At Garfield Avenue, which is in front of City Hall, there's a special street-level seating section for blind people. The tickets for that are given out months in advance, so you have to apply to the Tournament of Roses to get them for yourself and up to 3 companions. The Los Angeles Radio Reading Service has narrators who describe the floats and the horses and the bands as they go by, and the sight-impaired people can hear them on special audio headsets. And they also hold up a sign for the bands asking them to stop and play.
Oh, nice. So that sounds like a good spot to be nearby if you want to get a little extra music.
Absolutely. And I'm really amped up for the bands that are showing up this year. They've got the great bands coming for the Rose Bowl football teams, the Ohio State Buckeyes and the Washington Huskies, but also the Florida A&M Incomparable Marching 100 and the Alabama State University Marching Hornets will be there. These are two of the top marching bands from historically black colleges and universities in the countries. They're going to leave it all out there. So that's where I'm planning to hang out.
Very cool. And as you mentioned, there are always a lot of diehard people that camp out overnight so they can get a good spot to see the parade. Are there rules for people that are camping out there?
Campers can be on the sidewalk starting at noon. Then the entire parade route closes to vehicles at 10 tonight. And at 11, they can finally move chairs and sleeping bags out to the blue line in the street. That's called the honor line. Kids have to have adult supervision after 10. No bonfires, no alcohol, no ladders, no tents, no boxes, no sofas. Nothing that could conceal something horrible. Also, you can't just rope off public sidewalks or areas this year or put out like 20 chairs to save them for family or friends like some have done in past years. They have to be occupied, so butts in chairs, or the city says the chairs will be removed.
Wow.
Small barbecues are okay, but they want you to have a fire extinguisher to go with it.
As with any super crowded event here in Southern California, I think the thing that stresses most people out is, how am I going to get there? If I drive, where am I going to park? Should I take the Gold Line? What are your hot tips?
Okay, so the locals only trip. Drive to within about 6 to 8 blocks of the final mile of the parade and walk to it. Plenty of parking, and you know, you'll be standing behind 5 or 10 people, but no big deal. There's plenty of place to view the parade in the last mile. Better yet, take the metro to the Gold Line. It's a $3.50 round trip on your tap card. You can park at Union Station for $8 or one of the other remote lots like out in Universal City. Any of the Pasadena stations, Del Mar, Memorial, Lake or Allen, they're just a few blocks from the parade. So just, and if you're afraid you get lost, don't worry about it. Everybody's going to the same place.
All right, Sharon McNary, she is KPCC's infrastructure and Rose Parade correspondent. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
If you drive to the parade or anywhere else starting tomorrow, there's a few new road rules you may want to keep in mind. They are among the hundreds of laws taking effect in California in the new year. Some bad news: if you drive an older electric car or other low emissions vehicle that has a green or a white decal, you'll no longer be able to travel in the carpool lane by yourself. Red decals will now be required for single occupancy travel in high occupancy vehicle lanes in low and no emissions cars. Also, starting January 1st, new and used cars must have a temporary paper license plate before they are driven off the dealer's lot. Back now with Take Two. I'm Megan McCarty Carino in for A. Martinez. Netflix sets a new record, at least according to Netflix. Plus, the traditional box office is closing out the year with a new record of its own. Let's go on the lot for the last time in 2018.
God, I wish.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan is our guide, as always. Happy New Year's, Rebecca.
Hi, Happy New Year.
Netflix took to Twitter to brag that Sandra Bullock's film Bird Box had the best ever first seven-day showing for a Netflix film.
Listen to me. We are going on the trip now. It's going to be rough.
Hold on!
If you hear something in the woods, you tell me. You hear something in the water, you tell me. But under no circumstance are you allowed to take off your blindfold.
All right, so what kind of numbers did this bring in?
Well, Netflix says that more than 45 million accounts watched this thriller in its first 7 days of release on the streaming service. According to Netflix, that's the best first 7 days ever for a Netflix film. Mm-hmm. By the way, what that means, according to Netflix, is that 45 million people watched at least 70% of the total running time for the film.
Is it unusual for Netflix to be bragging about their numbers or even to be talking about them at all?
Yeah, Netflix is notoriously tight-lipped about their data, a fact of constant frustration to poor slobs like me whose job it is to make sense of the entertainment industry. By the way, they're not the only streamer that is quiet about its data. Amazon and Hulu don't share much either. The problem is there is really no such equivalent to, say, Nielsen ratings,
right,
or RentTrack, which follows the box office for streaming services. So we kind of have to take them at their word.
Take it with a little grain of salt there.
Yeah, and with some skepticism. I mean, as we've learned from media companies, with Facebook sort of fudging some data about their video downloads, and we learned that those were wildly inflated, people are sort of understandably skeptical about companies that share this information. Having said that, there's no question that Bird Box was a big phenomenon over the weekend.
All right, well, let's check in on the actual box office. Ticket sales in 2018 in the real life box office are projected to be up 6% from last year. So what are the big films that powered that strong box office showing?
Well, if we're looking domestically, the biggest movie of the year was Black Panther. Also, Avengers Infinity War, Incredibles 2. There was the Jurassic World sequel, Deadpool 2. You'll notice some themes here.
Sounds like a lot of Disney going on.
A lot of Disney, a lot of superheroes.
Superheroes, yeah.
And sequels, but
tentpole.
Definitely three of those top five were Disney.
Yeah, so how much of the market share was Disney's part?
Disney was about 26% in 2018. They've really figured out sort of the formula for these spectacle-driven event movies that seem to compel people off their sofas, away from their Netflix, into theaters. And it's, I think to some people it's a little concerning that one company could have so much power at the box office. Certainly to theater owners, who on the one hand are very grateful for Disney getting people out to movies, and on the other hand have to deal with Disney being pretty tough negotiators about which theaters they want and what sort of blocks of time they want. So it's sort of a double-edged sword for theater owners in that respect.
All right, and Disney potentially about to get even bigger, this pending 20th Century Fox deal. If it goes through, how much of the market would be owned by Disney at that point?
Well, yeah, then theater owners and I think it seems likely that this Disney-Fox deal will go through. About 37% of the market share would belong to Disney.
Wow.
So, for instance, those five movies that I listed, if you add in Fox, that would mean Disney would have four of the top five movies of 2018. Only a Universal movie, the Jurassic World sequel, would be not owned by them. So that's pretty incredible.
That is incredible. Incredible, too. Let's talk about Kevin Spacey now. He was one of the many names brought down by the Me Too movement last year. And now he's doing court next week with an assault allegation. Can you catch us up on what's happening there?
Right. Spacey's attorneys say he intends to plead not guilty to this count of indecent assault and battery. The allegation is that he groped an 18-year-old busboy at a restaurant in the summer of 2016. This is one of many allegations that have been brought forth against Spacey. As you said, we haven't seen him for a long time. Yeah. He kind of dropped from public view. His Netflix show House of Cards dropped him and filmed a new season with Robin Wright Penn at the center instead of Spacey. So it was kind of surprising to see him reappear.
Yeah, surprising to see him reappear in a strange video that he dropped on YouTube on Christmas Eve, seemingly as his House of Cards character Frank Underwood. What are people saying about this video?
Yeah, so this was a video where if you watched House of Cards, you recall that Spacey as Underwood would often turn to camera and
break the fourth wall.
Yeah, and so he shot a video in that form, kind of speaking out as his own advocate. I think people almost universally believe it was a bad idea, not only as a legal strategy, but as a PR strategy. Clearly, the things he's accused of are very serious. I mean, one of his accusers has an allegation that happened when he was 14 years old. So to sort of make light of it in a video in which he's playing a character did not seem to win him any points.
All right, let's get back to Netflix. On Friday, it released an interactive Black Mirror episode called Bandersnatch that lets you kind of choose your own adventure. I haven't checked this out yet, but is this the future of streaming interactive television?
Well, if you think about it, that is one of the main advantages streaming has over traditional TV is that you really can engage with it. And this was a sort of very involved process for the writers and creators of having to write these multiple endings. But it's actually a very smart and sophisticated use of the technology, I think. I would be surprised that we don't see more of it. That doesn't mean necessarily that I particularly want this. I did start thinking about, you know, some of my favorite films and shows, like, how would I change them? And I probably would have made them worse if I were choosing my own endings.
So just to play it out, which did you think about?
Well, I do think that Titanic, when Kate Winslet is on the door at the end and, you know, Rose and Jack are only one of them apparently can make it, but it's a really big door. And I've often wondered, like, could Jack have gotten on the door? Could they both have made it? The movie probably would not have had the sort of tragic arc and beauty that it did. But, you know, Jack might have been able to get on the door and live. I did also think about the end of Casablanca. Uh-huh. Like, what if Elsa doesn't get on the plane? I guess I want to reverse all these sad classic romances and let the people stay together.
I thought about the end of Rosemary's Baby, which I know is based on a book. But, you know, I always felt like it had such great ambiguity throughout the movie. And then the ending was so, so on the nose. Like, what if it was really more ambiguous about her mental state and stuff like that?
See, I'm making things more on the nose and you're making them less on the nose. I think you probably have a better plan there.
All right. Well, that's Rebecca Keegan with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Monday to talk about the business of Hollywood. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thanks, Megan.
And see you in 2019.
All right.
The Me Too movement was born in Hollywood, and it's inspired some new laws that will take effect starting tomorrow. We've been going over many of the 2019 laws, from road rules to gun regulations, in the show today. But when it comes to the workplace, thanks to Senate Bill 820, non-disclosure agreements signed on or after January 1st will be banned in sexual harassment, assault, and discrimination cases. Also, in other workplace matters, if you breastfeed while at work, know that employers must make a private space available for you other than a bathroom. Well, that's a wrap for Take Two in 2018. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next year on Wednesday, January 2nd.